Deputy Larkin was talking tonight about them, some of the waivers of the past. He mentioned Paul Coates and Gilbert Romani, who wrote Cork Benton for the defendants. And he was a deep rock priest who went to England and whenever it was, 1790 or 1800. So he was really sent to Coventry. And it's nice to see in this day and age that Cork boats are being sent to Coventry for different reasons. We're going to Coventry. This poem is called Aher. Aher means father in English.
Irish.
You get that?
Sorry,
take it again. Called Aher, which is Irish for father. My father was a great raconteur and he used to never tell me stories. He used to tell me other people. Aher. Funny, isn't it, Dad? In the good old days, I don't remember us talking too much. We never even went out for a pint. Oh yes, those were the good times, gone kind. You never were a man to give out advice, and I never asked for it, or even knew how. But I could not dream the time would come when you would say, kneel at the gun. Now my dreams have nothing but your face, giving your whole life for everyone. The morning comes and brings me down, the blackbird sings, kneel at the gun. Happy days when I asked my father, Cain Paul, the answer, the other. Thanks.
Next up we have Rebecca Perry Kirby.
Okay, I'm going to do a McCallum song about the Cork herders. Just to explain to people, the Cork herders, I think probably one person doesn't know about Cork herders here, but the Cork herders are on strike because they don't like their manager, and the manager refusing to set the price he wants to keep energy to see, even though he's no fair man. So this is my song. Sorry.
Yeah, I'll have one.
Have you heard about the Civil War?
Can you hear me, boy?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Have you heard about the Civil War? They've started up in Cork. We haven't seen the like of it since they put guns away up north. Well, some say the players are arrogant, away to second base. While others say the management team aren't even in the race. Well, the players have downed their tools and entered a dispute. No hurlies or slippers, but only words to refute. But the manager is stubborn and says he won't give in, but he'll be left with a team of pensioners to do Kilkenny in. Well, back come the heroes of yesteryear to play for Munster glory. The fans, they are in fear. How can a team of pensioners who are good in their day make even a team like Waterford, never mind Kilkenny pay? Well, in the first round against Kerry, the old men did their bit, since Kerry man can't hit the ball with a stick in a fist. The pensioners rejoiced, it was their greatest day, since they got the medical card back without having to pay. Well, next up came the men of Clare, with grievance to repair. 'Twas many a time they lost out to Corkmen fair and square. Well, this time they thought they had a chance, with the eight heroes playing. But what they hadn't counted on was Jimmy Barry Murphy was on song. Well, he might be past his very best at the age of 61. But he was scoring against the Clare boys all for his own fun. He scored 3-6 with ball and stick, and Clare were left reeling. I'm telling you, it gladdened the hearts of any old man with feeling. Eventually they lost, of course. How long could it continue? You can't win a championship with old men in situ. For while life goes to the slow and steady, hurling goes to the quick. And in this dispute I reckon that youth has the upper stick. Come on, good. Thank you.
Thank you. And next up, we have Eugene.
Sorry, John, I go to meet with appointment for 2 months before Tiger, they call it on Chuck Moore, Tashman, the Rock, Kunu, the Corridor, Gibbs, the Kinder, Arsan, easier to take the dark out of the night, the light out of the day, the green out of the grasses, than end our friendship. We cupped our hands and howled at the moon, made green hay, honey sweet.
Next up, could we have Barbara?
No, things so well. Just called human in general. I'm on the road, a slow drive, and yet how fast too. How many days would it take me to walk it, stop and correct and story tell my supper and tell the passage on the road. I'm in a worry over time, tapping fingers on the wheel. Don't I know by now the wheel is turning out my thoughts. I want to be a passing tribesman, flying over land. What strange magic you must have learned to take one feathered stride and land on the other side. I'm rushing the miles along, eager to somewhere else, so often somewhere else. And then something subsides, the most light of my mind slips, the lines of the circle shift. There's only this and this for this. There's only the road, the same luminous way as the pilot. Snake like river reflecting the sky. Metal skin to surface. My gold sail of all.
Thank you, Barbara. Next up, could we have Bree Patrick? Bree.
I told myself they were not good enough. The statement was not sprung from a high opinion of myself, but from a higher need, a higher quotient of satisfaction. A whole number was never what I wanted, more someone with a few fractions missing like myself. A man with some exact angle of few little hours of sight. A figure with decimals that could go on forever as the number five makes up the coordinates of a flower, in intervals, in its unstable beauty. They looked at me, and I offered my side of the equation with a vacuum of intensity, counting down the minutes on my abacus hand. With equal measures of negative and positive reinforcement, I refused to dose from total at end of page. I sat and analysed your problem, scrambled confused scribbles over many pages, and still couldn't help you up. I gave up eventually, distracted at my failure. You sat and talked to me with an amount of differentiation I could never figure out. And I told myself I wasn't good enough, hadn't read the books that meant to, that could have opened doors to mystic worlds that may be in that mind dimension we may have shared, hadn't stepped outside the glass prism I'd constructed for myself with shelter, although the drizzling shards of life had long since departed, hadn't been kind to myself by letting perspective push its persevering hand through for once. I told myself I wasn't good enough, and it was then that you knew it too. It struck you like a moment of eureka at the table. I told myself I wasn't good enough until it had been drafted on the page forever, an indisputable conclusion. The world gave a tilt, a sudden shift in angle. Your table slipped away from mine in a quantum slide across the darkening room. Knowing I wasn't good enough, you turned your eyes to the next girl at the table.
Thanks, Breed. Next up, the first time out of Vale, all the way down from Limerick, Noreen Troy.
Of wine fermented with time. That's how I feel. That's how I taste you. I've had some sips from your soft lips. The comforting warmth and social charm. A glass of bread, a glass of wine. Caring by day, comforting at night. Like a long stem glass, full of body with a touch of class. I savor the time with this man of mine.
Thanks, Noreen. Next up, could we have the big round of applause?
Hi. I was going to do a loop one tonight, but then I just wanted to pick up on the hurling team. So I do fumble hurling. And I thought I have to explain to the man from Coventry what hurling actually is. But then it won't be long before we've forgotten ourselves. The county board. The county board resigned. But
Our
hurling is a 10 net sport, played in Cork and other counties in the south of Ireland, and also in Antrim and Dun. And it's also an industrial relations nightmare. This is a poem about the god watching a hurling match. It's the Greek god. There was half time. Aphrodite sashayed from the kitchen with the tartan tea tray. Hermes looked from the soiled dinner dishes to the paisley wallpaper to the telly. He emitted a long sigh of boredom. Hurling, like most team sports, isn't much fun when you know how it finishes. And being God, they knew almost everything. Zeus absently stroked the remote, his lips curling in jaded disdain as Aphrodite placed a Twix mug in front of him. For to make matters worse, this was winter hurling. Not the top salad bowl stadiums of summer, dressed on Sunday's drench, in sizzling heat and sound, but their somehow Soviet winter alter egos. Slabs of grey, deserted masonry, under an oppressive, apprehensive junta of clouds. Hermes unslumped himself in his threadbare armchair. Let's repair, he said to his father, to the bottom-up slut club in Brighton. Take Katchka or Zuzana upstairs for a private dance. Or what about this? Let's turn all the lights on and off in Calcutta all at once. Feast on gorgeous chapatis. Gently molest two Bengali princesses in a dream each will wake from pregnant with a gold-clawed swan. Or we could make of ourselves some glittering evanescence and mate with nebulae out of the galaxy's freezing edge. Leave them sprawl the eternities of pulsing want. Planet pregnant. Pregnant with stars. Or at least can we turn the station over to Hitler's henchmen, or can fast teams hunt? Hermes fell silent, fidgeted with a chocolate digestive, mumbled under his breath. Aphrodite began clattering the carting dinner dishes to the kitchen. Zeus looked into the ripples in his dark brown tea. Hush, he said. The second half starting.
That's my favorite for the original poem of all time, so definitely. Next up to the open mic, all the way from the North Seas of Europe, the breathing coastline of Latvia. Mr. Alan Tilley.
Thomas Hardy once wrote a poem on Dover Beach, which is with the destruction of faith and religion, and this is my version. It's called "The Bishop Who Stuck His Finger in the Dike." Right. It's a story, not a poem. "Come quickly," the boy shouted in a panic. "There's a hole in the dike and the water's rushing in." The bishop sighed at yet another emergency, but at least it wasn't anyone crying wolf. He got out of bed, lifted his belly after him, leaned on his crozier, put on his purple robes, wondered why the Galatians never replied to Paul, since he'd written to them, and strolled down to the shore. This time the boy was right. He was a nice boy. He knew he was a nice boy. The water wasn't rushing in, as he said, but there was a hole the size of a wagging finger or a stubby thumb in the dike, and some water was indeed pouring through. It was a sort of pour that would fill a decent wine glass in about 7 seconds. And the dike was the only protection that the flock had against the big bad sea which rocked and rolled all the way to the west. He stuck his finger in the dike to stop the flow. As it was not an unpleasant sensation, he said to the boy, "Go thou unto the town, and get the workers and the laity, and the ordinary people who clean the church, and serve the food, and till the fields, and teach in school, and make the children, and tell them that God's church doth need them quickly, and even pronto." The boy did as he was told. He was a good boy, and a friend of the bishop's. Off he went as fast as his legs would carry him, as he sure as hell had no other means of transport, and left the bishop there with his finger stuck firmly in the dike. The bishop quickly began to understand that the water was not going to stop that easily, as it was now trickling up his wrist, in under his sleeve, travelling inexorably towards his arm to lodge under the warm, hairy hole of his shoulder. Very soon he had to put his two fingers in, and this didn't cause him any discomfort either. But he then discovered that his two fingers were widening the fissure rather than solving the problem. With a certain degree of frustration, he shoved his whole hand in. He had to push it right up the hilt, and yet they hadn't come. He dug his crozier deep into the earth for support, and then stuck his two hands into the hole, which was now light onto a big crack. It made little difference. The sea rushed in over his two hands, then up to his neck, then washing his ears, then over his head, while down below it was up to his knees. He thought he was done for. Something at the back of his head told him that he'd once seen a film of the flood, or maybe it was Moses parting the Red Sea with his rod. But just then, he saw the boy and the people of the village coming over the haunches of the hill. They shouted to him, "Let go, let it be! There's no good, there's no use, get out or you'll be drowned!" He thought he heard someone say, "Get the finger out!" But he knew it was unlikely that anyone had a sense of humour at a time like this. For some reason, he obeyed them. It hurt him to have to obey the laity, but it was either that or death. The wide, thick, slopping sea lapped around his mouth and sucked at his breath. He let go and was swept with the tide. Down the fields he went, and then past the church where he had preached, and the village green where he had controlled their play, and the parish hall where he had supervised their leisure, and through the streets of the town where he had walked in suitable procession. He saw the people out at their doors and at their windows, waving to him and shaking their arms. This cheered him much, and he raised his hands to bless them in return. He didn't realize, however, that they were waving him goodbye.
Thank you. Anybody else like to say a poem? Fiona? Anyone?
No?
Stephen?
Tommy?
Come on, dear friend. Tommy, let me put it. The dispenser of my
memory. My thoughts are clear like a crystal fountain, as the river runs with the breeze, comes to the edge and secret spot, comes to the spot. Over yonder lies the ocean, with waves that will carry you over the mountains of time back to the foothills of dreams. And we will fly over the silent sea, and we will carry our dream beyond us. The music is our dreaming, and the dreaming is our song, and our vision sets us forward to a place we know we belong. Run with time to the fields of open starlight, to the quiet place where the spirit of light rests in your heartbeat, a sacred fire to the flame within. A sacred fire to the flame within.
No more poems out there? Nope. 18 verses 12. John asked me to read him Scanning the Poet, which I haven't done here for a while, so it didn't sound to me. 4.5 minutes of Scanning the Poet. Or so. Scanning the Poet, which I'm sure you've all heard. One day created his pencil for a lens and his paper for a reel. Wrote these new poems, I ear poems, poetess poems. Scanning the Poet one day sent his very eyes into exile, into flux, to breathe, you see. Scanning the Poet now swam in a new sea of satire. Iambic celluloid, anapestic f-stop, dactylic actors, an alliteration of lighting and diversification of vision. Scanning the Poet was in a very different sea of sound effects, of irony, the sea of modern prosody, of new closed forms. Ask Petrarch and Scanning for a modern sunrise sonnet and you'll receive. When aiming camera, just make sure to think that all the mise-en-scene is balanced well, that all the actors have their lines to tell, that shades and hues and shadows are in sync. When if you need your players not to blink, to shield their eyes from sun's own jealous yell, to fan and nudge their egos to excel, make sure to look as if you're on the brink of breaking through to poetry unseen, of bringing through the actor's greatest day, of culminating new creation streams. For when the thespian instincts will not play, suspects the charioteer about to fold, the last word of each line is never told. Ask Stuart Scanani, an ancient anamorphic quatrain, and he'll smile in plain and say another sonnet to Joseph, two quatrains, opus, historium, clio, mysterium. Ask Labour Scanani while facing a prop, a limerick to requite, and he'll recite. There was an old actor from yore, who thought that to film was a bore, so he moved all his grace from his hands to his face, and entered the stage and nevermore. Scanning the Poet was in a completely different sea of emotion and morality. Ask him for a villanelle and he'll answer with five tercets and a step-dressing quatrain. I found a poet in me and sighed when he me saw an artist finally free. The road to mastery, the softened cheerful pour, I found a poet in me. Unraveling mystery, the feathered forms, a claw, I found a poet in me. An artist find a tree. I now could speak with tree, have arguments with floor. I found a poet in me. To flee or not to flee a danger to the law. An artist finally free. It's best I climb a tree. There were the crows I'll call. I found a poet in me. An artist finally free. Cinque, sixteen, rondo, rondo, wunde, rondo, redouble, triole aussi. Ask for a haiku. Swift sun, surgeon, shining seas, 90-page screenplay. A movement and emotion. Scanning the Poet was worrying now in a very different sea of symbols and imagery, a sea of newly dreamed cities and new open forms, of scripted cobblers, of ad-lib odes, of couplet cameos, a rhyming montage of troubadouric flashbacks, of scheduled epigrams and stilted ballads. Delirious Scanning the Poet was panicking now in this completely different similar sea. Tempsarima shadow speed, Hand tune closer, see how I am seeing the cattleboard. Continuity glad, bit of light nouveau light meters and focused willing order. Onomatopoeic stampeding crowds, new phonetic zoomings, homeoproferon animal handlers, makeup consonant swindlers and assonant stunt predictors, the rhythm and effect of accelerating producers, sustaining pia separata atmospheres, the phonetic rhetoric of the assistant director, and talkie iteratio of the walkie-talkie, libograms and inner dialogues and outer of discernment, the caesura of discretion. Skinami the poet, staring at the rhyming crew and the cast, at the unrhyming entireties of his shippy's head, rich rhyme, mirror rhyme, identity rhyme, virtual rhyme, in decasyllabo, Gallic decasyllable, Alexandrine, iambic pentameter, all mercilessly sent to the slaughter of booms and gates and gels and mics, and of avant-garde gung-ho, fame-spangled hotheads. Da 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 to the nursery rhyme, Africus. Who blues? Iambically, take 10. A troche age action. And eventually, it's a wrap. In the can. Dactylic telemetry. An amphibraic filtration of spondaic faux pas, empiric edits. Skirani stress patterns and tightrope meters, designer syllables, all lost. Drowned, we are Skirani, the poet, by the concrete camera, and the seventh art.